Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Comic Chronicle Podcast. I'm your host, Dakota Morgan, coming to you from Phoenix, Arizona, in the home studio. So, guess what, folks? J.M. DeMatteis is on the show. Obviously, if you listen to the show, you've known his work from the Justice League shows, Beyond Justice, Constantine animated movies, Justice League Dark. Hell, moreover, his work on Spider-Man, his work on Marvel, DC Comics. He's an Eisner Award-winning writer on the show today. He talks about his work, of course, but you know, we also, him and I talk about being creatives, and we talk a lot about details of writing and create of characters and things to look for, things to do, and we relate on a whole bunch of shit. And I don't want to spoil any more of it, but let's just say if you're a creator and you're also a fan of comics, or even if you're just a fan of comic stuff in general, you're really going to love this episode. Before we get, though, to this episode, I do have to ask you guys, make sure you guys subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or comiccronicle.podbean.com. It really helps us, folks. Leave a review. It also helps. We want to know what you guys think of the show. And also, if you can share the show, use hashtag Comic Chronicle or hashtag The Comic Chronicle Podcast on Twitter or Instagram. It really helps us, folks. We're doing some really fun things for you guys and whatnot, some really cool things coming up. But we really need you to share the show. It also helps us out greatly. There's a lot of listeners, but we want more listeners. We want to help you guys out by giving you guys fun podcasts with comic guests. Thanks so much for tuning in. And now, my talk with J.M. DeMatteis. And yeah, we're recording right now. Welcome to the show, man.
Happy to be here.
Wow. And I gotta say, is we just talked about writing beforehand, just like 2 seconds before, and I gotta ask, where do you get time to do all of the stuff that you do? Like, it's just as a writer myself, I'm really curious to know.
You know, it's a weird thing. I've been a freelance writer for like 40 years.
Holy.
You know, sometimes you go through periods where there's not a lot going on and you have like one or two projects and you're stretching them out, and you have other times when you've got like a dozen projects that you're juggling. And if it's what you do, it's what you do. And you know that when all the work comes in at once, you got to do it, because in 2 months there might be nothing or just one project. And you just, it's just a skill that you learn from years of being a freelancer. What, you know, when the work comes, you do it. Because no matter how long you do it, you never know what next month is going to bring. It's just the way it goes.
That's true. And I do love that about the business that we work in, because there's a little bit of uncertainty a little bit.
A lot of uncertainty sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You never know. It'll be like, you're on a big movie. It's like, well, the movie just wrapped. Oh, what's next month? We don't know. Oh.
Right. Or you're in the middle of a project and something happens and the project gets killed. And, you know, there's so many things that can and do go wrong. Or you pitch a project and it looks like it's sold and you're going through all the things. And this has happened to me recently. I won't say with who. And then you get a contract and you look at the contract and you go, you got to change that term or I can't sign it. And then they go, well, we can't change that term. And all of a sudden the contract, the project that was a sure thing, evaporates. You know, so I call freelancing, I always say it's like tap dancing on quicksand. You have to tap dance really fast so you don't sink. And then you have to tap dance really well so all the people go, ooh, look how well he dances. I'll hire him, you know? Yeah. So, and yet I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. It's been a great life for me. You know, it's been a fantastic life, even with the times where it's a little stressful and a bit of a struggle. It's been and continues to be a great ride.
I'm into that. I agree full-heartedly, just being in. I mean, I'm technically an ant compared to the years you've been a freelancer, so I got like 2 years against 40 here, so
And I'm only 39. That's the incredible thing, you know? It's amazing.
In the womb, you just never know.
I started very early, telepathically from the womb.
It's amazing. Now, I love that quote, by the way, and that quote has to be on your autobiography whenever you do one.
Which one?
Oh, quicksand.
Oh, the quicksand. Yeah.
It's gotta be. It's gotta be.
But it's really true. It's an accurate representation of what the freelance life is like.
Oh, God, yeah. As a freelancer in writing, acting, also set design and building and all that jazz, yeah. It's like, you may think, because you do more than one job, it's more easier. It is not.
No, but the great part of it is you get to do something that you love. And if you're lucky enough to actually make your living at it, which I have been, who could ask for anything more? to make your living doing the thing that you love, but being creative. I mean, come on, you know, it's like many, if not most of us who were creative, we were just so creative our whole lives. As a kid, I spent half my childhood on the floor in my living room drawing pictures or writing stories or playing the guitar or whatever it is. And to be able to make my life being creative is an extraordinary thing. And I never take that blessing for granted.
No, you never can. I mean, once you do, I like to say once you lose like the eyesight of that, then all of a sudden you lose the inner child you that got you into the business in the first place.
Like exactly. And that's, those are the times when I always say what I need to always need to do is take a half step back and go find that kid. Go find 10-year-old me and say, guess what I do for a living? And watch as he faints dead away. Do you know what I mean?
That's true.
And as soon as you reconnect with that kid, you go, oh, yeah, you're reading that Spider-Man comic book. You know how much Spider-Man I've written over the years? And he faints and I'm happy, you know?
Yeah. So. Oh, God, yeah. It's like there. That's the thing. That's how you determine whether or not you want to be a part of that project. At least is what I do. Is if that inner child you, it's like, do it now, sort of thing. Do it.
And then once you're engaged in the process, you know, it's exactly the same as it was. You know, I use that kid as that image of that kid on the floor drawing because it's pure creativity. You know, and it doesn't matter. You know, what you're being paid or what the project is, once you're into the project, once you're into that creative flow, you're not thinking about the check at the end or anything but the joy you're having in the moment creating that thing. And it's the same exact joy you had when you were a kid doing it. And those are the moments that we all live for.
It's true. You need to write an autobiography. Like you, I think it'd be
one thing I do is I teach a writing workshop where I get to talk about a lot of this stuff.
Ooh.
And I have one coming up November 8th through 10th. It's just about, we have room, we could squeeze in maybe one or two more people at most. But if anyone is curious about it, it's in Kingston, New York. I've got people coming literally from other countries for this. I've done a number of them over the years. And we talk about the practicalities of writing. And the metaphysics, all the cool sort of metaphysical aspects of the creative process. And it's a whole weekend. I keep it small, maybe a dozen people tops in the class. And it's a really good class. So if you wanna know more about it, you go to my website, jmdmateus.com, go to the workshop section, and there'll be information there in a contact email.
That's awesome. I love when people go out there and people huge like yourself go out and talk to people who are trying to be not them, but their own version of themselves and to be something that they want to be. And I love when people like you guys go out and go do that. Hell, my voice acting career a little bit has been predicated on that because there was one of the actresses who played Velma was my teacher. And so she's like, I want to run a home studio. I want to teach people. That's an awesome thing to see these days, you know?
It's a great thing, and I it's a cliche, but I always find that by the time the work weekend is over, I've learned things as well because of the questions that are asked or the insights that are offered. Or sometimes, you know, you do something for years and years and years, and you're not analyzing it, you're just doing it. And so when you're hit with a question about something you've taken for granted for years and you have to analyze it in order to answer it and give them some clarity, you learn about yourself while you're teaching other people, and it's a great thing.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. You mentioned childhood you a little bit, and I love hearing people's origin stories, Jam. And I really want to know, like, what got you into being a writer, man? Like, what was that thing where you had that turning point and said, you know what? I want to create. I want to do stuff. I want to draw. I want to sit down in my living room and write.
You know, it goes back to exactly what we were talking about. I was just always a creative kid. I always joke that, you know, God didn't make me good at very many things. You know, like half of my brain always felt like it was dead, and I really struggled in school with learning disabilities and all these things. Mm-hmm. But the creative side of my brain was wide open. So as I said, art, I think, was my first love as a kid. I spent a lot of time drawing, but I also liked to make up stories. So I remember sitting with my friends, as a lot of us did, writing and drawing our own comic books, you know, and making up our own stories. And then along came my passion for rock and roll, and I learned guitar, and I became a songwriter and played in bands for years. And I just discovered along the way that I had sort of a natural gift for writing. Mm-hmm. And it's at a certain point, I'm condensing a very long story. You know, at a certain point, I was also doing rock and roll journalism, writing reviews and doing interviews and things like that, and trying to get my foot in the door in comics, and realized that I don't want to be the guy that's sitting there writing reviews and critiquing and criticizing other people. Mm-hmm. I would rather be the creative person putting the work out in the world and getting critiqued, you know. So I kind of gave up the journalist side of my brain and went straight in purely with the creative. And you know, luckily enough, you knock on doors and you bang your head against enough walls, eventually they crack, and magically, you have a career.
Yeah, I like that. I really, really love that, because that is 100% creative all the time, and you just have different outputs for creativity, and you never know what one might lead to another sort of thing. And that's
exactly, and that's something I talk about a lot too. I talk about it in the classes too. Mm-hmm. I always say, follow your passion, whatever it is. If it's the thing that really, really sets your heart afire, follow it. It may not lead you exactly where you expect to go, but it will lead you someplace good. Because along the way, following that passion, you may hit a brick wall that makes you go, oh, I can't go forward, I have to turn to the right. And on the right is a door that you never expected. Mm-hmm. And you walk through that door, and it's a career opportunity that wasn't part of your plan, but ends up being, you know, phenomenal. So you just never know. You just never know.
Exactly.
You know, I talk about my career in animation, which I've been doing for a long time now, but it wasn't part of the plan. It was just, by, you know, through doing comics, I met other people that opened certain doors and led this way and that way, and suddenly I had a flourishing career in a field that I never thought about twice before I entered it, really. And I've loved it. It's been a great part of my career.
And I gotta say, is with those, a lot of them are like huge icons. That's the thing. It's like, they're not small things. Like, everything you've done with animation has been like huge, huge icons. Justice League Unlimited, Constantine, Justice League Dark. There are all these big, Young Justice for another one too. Like, what has that been like, seeing all your work that maybe you're, okay, this is going to do well, but even to 2019, seeing the fan service and the fanfare for it, what has it been like for that?
Well, it's, you know, I don't know that much about the reactions to these things. I find with the animated movies, it's not quite the same as with comics, where every issue, virtually every panel, is constantly analyzed and you're always getting feedback. But what I do see is at conventions, when we go, like, they'll do a big premiere and they'll do it at WonderCon or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other audience in a lot of ways. There's crossover between the comic book audience and the animation audience, mm-hmm. but there's also just an animation audience, people that love these characters in animated form but don't necessarily follow them in comics. And they are a huge, enthusiastic crowd. I think a few years ago when we did the Batman versus Robin movie at WonderCon, they had 5,000 people show up to see this movie. Something is, it was like, I couldn't believe it. And they were doing these panels with these huge audiences. And it's great. It's just really fun. I've got a bunch of things coming up that have recently been announced. I have an adaptation of Superman Red Son, which will be out next year. For CW Seed, I have a Deathstroke animated series that I've written, which will eventually be released with extra footage as a full-length movie. Then the Wonder Woman Bloodlines movie is coming out on DVD soon, and I wrote a short for that, which is the first appearance of Neil Gaiman's Death character, I believe, in any other media. So that's pretty cool. And then one of the movies later in the year will also have an Adam Strange short that I wrote. And I've got a couple episodes of the new Spider-Man animated series coming up as well.
You just tackle everybody. And you just put a whole lot of writers that listen to the show to be like, wow, I've been put in my place.
I'm not putting anybody in my place. I'm just trying to pay the mortgage.
Fair. That's true. That's hugely important. And I like to eat, you know?
Yes, eating is good. Taking care of the family is really good. Yeah. Paying the mortgage, all those things, you know?
Oh, yeah. What is the difference, like, between, because I've never written anything for animation yet, and I've heard a little bit of people who've talked about it, but what is, like, is there a huge difference between writing for animation and then also for comics? Like, or is it, like, do you prefer
absolutely.
One or the other?
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't prefer one to the other, because they feed different parts of me. Hmm. You know, with comics, there is tremendous freedom to pursue your vision, your way. Even when you're working on these iconic characters, I've been lucky enough to have editors that really let me do what I wanted and tell my story in a very deeply personal way. I've done stuff, you know, with mainstream Marvel and DC characters that were just as personal as some of the creator-owned work I've done. And then when you get into creator-owned work, there's nobody telling you what to do, you know? Yeah. You're telling your story, you and the artist, exactly the way you want to. When you're working in television, when you're working in film, especially if you're a freelancer, not if you're the producer, you know, or the guy on staff, but I'm always a freelancer. Mm-hmm. You are working with a team, and it's to say a TV series where they say, okay, we've got the season mapped out. We've got some stories we want to tell. Here's the general idea for a story that we want to tell in this episode. You take that story, you develop it. You're on the phone sometimes with three or four people, you know, bouncing ideas around, getting notes, going back. So the challenge and the joy for me is when I'm working on a comic, it's first of all, when writing a script, it's just me in the room, you know, and I may talk to the artist about it, but it's a small group, and then you have some feedback from your editor, and that's it. This is, you're working as part of a group, so I sort of take off that hat where it's like, this is my story to be told in my way, and I put on my team hat. And as long as I switch those hats, it's great fun. For the very reason I spend so much time alone in the room, it's great to be working with all these different creative people, and the majority of what I've done has been with Warner Brothers Animation and all these great people like Jim Krieg and Bruce Timm and Alan mm-hmm. Burnett, great guys who really, really know story. So it's wonderful to be working with them and bouncing ideas around. So it's a different flavor. It's a different flavor. But at the same time, sometimes you do get these projects where you know, once you get the notes, you're off and it's so, you know, sometimes I've written things for some TV shows and stuff because they haven't liked the work, but because of production needs, things get rewritten and the show comes on and you go, that's not what I wrote. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Your name is
not
that.
Or, oh good, there's a line I wrote, you know? And then other times it's like, oh God, that's exactly what I wrote. Constantine was one of those projects, and this upcoming Deathstroke, very similarly, where the CW Seed process was, you know, we sit, we work out the story, I get the notes, but then they let it be. And very often too, when you're dealing with TV shows, you know, you turn in your script and the staff is dealing with all kinds of issues and problems that I don't understand. And once I turn it in, the staff writers will do the corrections or fix the things that production says we can't do this, but we can't do that or whatever. And the fun of these recent CWC projects is that whatever the problem comes up, they always call me. So it's like, oh, that's great. So I'll fix it. You know, but on a TV series where they're cranking it out and cranking it out, you know, they have episode after episode to take care of. So they're not going to keep coming back to me for every little fix. They're moving on to the next episode. But even with that, it's just been a great experience. I mean, I've gotten to work with, you know, Justice League Unlimited and Batman Brave and the Bold and Ben 10 and so many other really fun shows, and working with really, really great people who I enjoy. So yeah, there's a slight trade-off, but the other part of it is that I get to collaborate with these guys, and these shows go out, and one episode of these shows reaches more people than an individual comic book will ever reach. You know, when you're reaching millions of people on your worst day, you're reaching millions of people. That's a great thing.
True, and they always, like, comics, I hate saying this because it sounds like I'm not a comic fan, which I am, but comics in the sense, they have that limited, you're right, they have that limited time and be able to see and whatnot, and eventually your issue will go to back issues, and the back issue bin for, like, in a store somewhere, or just maybe digital, it's maybe highlighted or something like that. But the shows, that you can always go on YouTube and find them. You can always go on the DC Universe app and get it now, because that's, streaming's the big thing.
Right.
You can have that. You have it at your disposal all the time. Well, comics, you don't really have that. And it kills me. Maybe one day that would change. I really, really hope it will.
But well, I think more and more as things go, move to digital, that it will be that way. There'll be a library that's always out there that you can dip into whenever you want.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank God we have, you know, the trade paperbacks, which have become a huge part of the business.
Yes.
And, you know, there are stories of mine that, you know, when I wrote it, the collected editions were like, just something like Kraven's Last Hunt, you know, there had been some collected editions, but they weren't like doing it all the time. And I remember Kraven came out and they collected it in a hardcover. That was a big deal back then. And it's been in print for 30 years.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing, you know, an amazing thing. Or the Justice League stuff I've done with Giffen, you know, where they keep reprinting it, and then it goes out of print, and they bring out a new edition, and it's great, you know, to have these projects that sustain and live on that way, so that people literally are reading it for the first time now, and they come up to me at conventions, and they're like, I just read this last week, and it's really gratifying, and that's what you hope for.
Yeah.
At the same time, there are certain projects that I've done which I think are some of my best work, and they've yet to be collected. And you scratch your head sometimes over the things that get collected. Then there are things that you don't want anyone to ever see again that gets collected.
True.
You know? Why did they collect that? I I hate that story, you know?
Oh, 100%. I've had issues.
But even that, you know, I've learned over the years that I'm not always the best judge, and sometimes the story that I hate mm-hmm. is a story that really means the world to somebody else. Yeah. So that's why I try never or rarely to knock any of my own work in public, because that story could mean a lot to somebody else, and I don't want them to feel like, well, gee, why do I like this? The guy that wrote it thinks it's a terrible story. You know, that's an awful feeling, you know?
Yeah, it's like, well, is my time wasted, or am I an idiot, or what's happening here?
Exactly. You know, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and John Lennon was always super, super critical of his own work. And you read these interviews where he'd say, oh, that was a piece of garbage. I hated that. That sucked. And it's like, no, that's a great song, you idiot. I love that, you know? And you know, I don't want people to feel the same way, you know, by me knocking my own work. So I've learned it's been a long haul to respect my younger self, with all the flaws that I may see in the work, to respect the passion and the creativity that went into those stories.
Hey folks, Dakota here with a little bit of an ad break for you guys today. Do you guys like reading comics? Obviously, if you listen to the show, you do. What the fuck am I talking about? Then you guys, if you're in Arizona, which a good majority of the fan base is, shout out to the ones in Canada though, you guys can go to Drawn to Comics in Glendale, Arizona, located at 5801 West Glendale Avenue in Glendale, Arizona. I gotta say, folks, I've been going here for a long time now. I've been to a few different comic book stores in Arizona in my 6 years of living here so far, and this may change due to the recording nature, but whatever. So I love going to Drawn to Comics. I really do. Ken, who runs it, is amazing, fucking laid-back dude. He's a wonderful guy. He's been on the show, ladies and gentlemen, before. And it's a really fun place to pick up the book. So Drawn to Comics in Glendale, Arizona. Get yourself a box, you know. Go in, maybe just check it out. It's a fun place to escape into. All the workers there are fucking wonderful folks. They really are. It's just like family at this point, at least they're for me. And it's a fun world to go into. There's collectibles there. There's toys. There's comics. You know, and you just get your box and reserve some books and whatnot. We've had people on the show who've written and drawn comics, you know. Go in and pick up their work, folks. Jesus Christ. It ain't that difficult. So go to Drawn the Comics in Glendale, Arizona, folks. You guys can check them out also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thanks, everyone. Now back to the show. Love it. I love it. I am curious, though, with respecting the younger self, do you still play guitar?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I play guitar, I play piano. I mostly use guitar and piano for writing songs these days, because I still write. And I just love to play. I rarely play publicly. This past summer, I played at a music festival in North Carolina. It was the first time I performed before a big audience in years, and it was a blast. It was great. But that's not something that I do with any regularity. But music is a part of me, and it will always be a part of me. And it's almost the primal part of me in some ways. So yeah, that will never go away.
I love that. You can't really let it go. I love that you still play and whatnot, because there's people who I know would be like, why do I play? No, I'm doing writing full time. It's like, no, you might want to take a step back and play for a little bit too. But like, if you
it's
ever...
it's important creatively. Yeah, it's important. It's a great, you know, other people have said this, but it's true. Sometimes if you're having trouble with the writing, step away. Go play your guitar for a while. Go write a poem. Go do something else creative that has nothing to do with writing. And you're moving those channels along in a different way, and it opens you up in a different way, and then you can return to that. What I find fascinating, I find the whole creative process fascinating, where stories come from, where music comes from. And I just, in preparing for this gig that I did this summer, you know, I primarily have been writing on the piano, so I hadn't been playing my guitar as much as I've been playing the piano, and this gig was going to be me alone on an acoustic guitar, you know? So I had to refamiliarize myself with the guitar after really not playing it with any regularity for a few years. And the amazing thing that I found, and this has happened several times over the years, that I picked the guitar up after not playing it, and I'm playing better than I did before.
Ooh.
So what process is going on in my unconscious mind while I think I'm not playing, you know?
Uh-huh.
Or even to go with what we're talking about, is there something in the writing, when I'm writing, that's feeding into the musician in me so that when I pick up the guitar again, it changes how I play and improves how I play. It's the whole thing is fascinating to me.
The human mind is, I love to tell people this, is the human mind is your best friend, but also your worst enemy.
Yeah, I think your conscious mind can be your worst enemy. I think your unconscious is your best friend. You know?
That's a better way of putting it.
I learned this years and years ago to really, really trust the unconscious mind. Mm-hmm. So many times when I'd find myself, oh God, I'm so stuck, I don't know where the story's going to be. And then you walk away, and I always say, you know, I lay on the floor staring into space for 2 days. And without me trying, all of a sudden, up from the depths of my unconscious comes a movie solving the problem of the story. I just watch it. Oh, that's what happens. And then I'll go back, write it down. You know, I've had entire stories come to me that way. And it's from the not trying and the allowing of the unconscious mind to open up and deal with this stuff. That's when I finally figured out, oh, 99 and 9/10% of the time, there is no such thing as writer's block. Writer's block is just your unconscious. Your conscious mind hasn't keyed into it yet, but your unconscious mind is working on the story. So step away, take a walk, play the guitar, whatever we're talking about, and let your unconscious do its job. And it will. You know, sometimes there are times in our lives where there's a lot of stress going on and we've got things going on in our lives that really, really do prevent us from working. But that's a small percentage of the time. Most of the time, what we call writer's block is just our unconscious working on the story. So take a step back, take a breath, let your unconscious do it. I don't know how many times I've, like, you know, woken up in the morning and suddenly, like, whoa, what's that? And then, you know, I'm laying there with my eyes closed and there's this movie playing. Well, that's interesting. Really? Oh, look at that. Then I run to the computer and write down what I just saw.
I thank God you teach. Because that's all right. You took what I usually say and made it into something, a beautiful butterfly.
Thank you.
I mean, you're not wrong in the slightest there. I really, really, truly believe that, because you just never know, and you never know what that small thing you could do. Like, say if you just go read a book and you're just thinking about it, it'd be like, wait a minute, and that thing just clicks. Because when that thing clicks, it's like a whole new world. It's a whole excitement in there, and you're like, this idea. Like, I always keep I don't know if you do this at all or not, but when I go travel and whatnot, if I'm going out or something like that, I usually keep like a book with me for each one of the series I do. And I'll sometimes take one or two. If I get an idea, I put it in the notebook. So notebook's like, it looks like Chinese language, but is having all these notes. And so you have these, like, when you think of something right and you put it in there and you have it with you. So when you go back, you go home, you sit down, you open up the laptop or turn on the computer and you open up your notebook and be like, yes, because you might forget about it. I always find that helpful. Do you do that too, or...?
You know, I don't, but what I always have either the computer or my iPad or something with me. So if an idea really sort of pops up and grabs me and I know I need to get it down, I can always get it down that way. And also, I find that the big ideas really, really root. They really root. And they stay with me so that when I do get to the final, you know, get to the nearest keyboard, you know, if they evaporate, then probably they're not the ideas that are going to lock in and stay with you. The ideas that should be there will stick with you. But not that it's a bad idea to write it down. I'm not saying that. But I think, you know, getting back to the Beatles, I remember reading an interview with Paul McCartney where he said something very similar. He said, you know, we didn't really write down with the songs. You know, John and I would sit down, we'd write the songs, and we figured if they were really, really good, the next day we'd still remember it. And if we didn't remember it the next day, it was probably a crappy song, you know? And there's some truth to that. Although there are times, yeah, absolutely, where... What was that idea that I had the other day? Oh, shit, I don't remember. That's happened to me with music, where I sit down, I start banging on the piano, and I haven't recorded it, I haven't written anything down, and I thought, oh, this is really good. And a couple of days go by, and I go back to the piano, it's like, I have no idea what I was playing the other day. And you have to assume that it was just for that moment, and you sort of sent it off into the universe, and there it goes, you know? And if it's meant to be more concrete in the world, it'll come winging back.
I love it. Oh, I love it. Now, kind of going to comics a little bit here again, what would you say would be your process for, like, what would you say would be, like, your thing, like, when you're sitting down for a comic or doing a book, whoever it may be, what would you say you kind of start with and go with on that? Like, what is kind of your process for that a little bit? Because there's been writers who have been contacting me and be like, you got to ask, like, a writer questions like that. I'm like, okay. So this is, like, a fan question to be like, what is the process for when you sit down and going at a comic? Because there's a bunch of comic writers who do listen to the show.
Right. You know, it's the same thing we're talking about. You're looking for that inspiration. And, you know, you're doing it. Usually if it's a creator-owned book like that, it's the idea comes first. You know, same thing. I'm laying around. This movie starts in my head. And I just did a series for Karen Berger over at her new line at Dark Horse called The Girl in the Bay, collected edition out now. And you know, that started with I was away on vacation, and it was like I was getting this download from some other dimension, and all this stuff was coming. And that was one time where I was out on vacation, staying in this little cabin in the woods, run back to the cabin, grab my computer, write down pages and pages of stuff. And then you look for a venue the place where you can, a publisher to pitch the idea to and sell the idea to, and then there's that leap from that raw idea, that movie that gets downloaded into your head, and now you have to construct it into something real, and that's a different step. I did a series about 10 years ago for IDW called The Life and Times of Savior 28. And one of the best things I've ever done, I think, and certainly in terms of superhero stories. It was my, after like working in the business for so many years, this was my look at the sort of the underbelly of the comic book mythos. And it started with an idea I had like in the 80s when I was writing Captain America. And I nursed that idea for years and years and years and pitched it and people didn't get it and then put it away, reworked it, pitched it, people didn't get it. Finally set it up at IDW with my buddy Mike Caballero. And I knew this idea backwards and forwards, but when I sat down to write, after sitting with this idea literally for decades, it was like, shit, what do I do?
Damn.
How do I tell? How I've got the story, but the next step is how do I tell this story? Is it linear? Am I jumping back and forth in time? Who's telling the story? What's the point of view? That's a big part of things. I talk about this a lot in my class, you know? And for me, that's a big one. Is this an omniscient narrator? Is it first person by the main character? Is it first person by a subsidiary character? And that's what I came to with Savior 28. It was one of the secondary characters who's telling the story from a fairly jaundiced viewpoint, so you never know whether he's telling you the truth or not while you're watching events unfold. But that's a really important part of it, you know, wrestling with the point of view on the story. And then, hopefully, once you get all that and you kick it into gear, the same thing that happens with the movie happens again. The story just takes over. The characters take over. They start talking to each other. I'm not writing dialogue. They're talking to each other. I'm not telling the story. The story's telling me what to do. That's when it's working. That's what happens. Now, sometimes, maybe because you're not connected to that story in the right way, or because there's a certain deadline, or because a lot of different reasons, you have to depend on your craft. And I've been doing this long enough that I know how to take all the pieces of pipe that make a story and put them together into a story, you know, with a beginning, middle, and end, and some real emotion in it. But what you really want, obviously you need your craft, but what you really want is that engine to take off on its own. You know, the other thing I like to say is I imagine the story as a horse, right? You're on this horse and you have a goal. You're going 6 miles straight ahead, or so you think, across this desert, right? And you start to gallop and the horse starts pulling off toward the right. But wait, that's not where I'm going. So you try to go forward again, and it pulls off to the right again, and you go forward again, and there comes a point where you realize the horse knows better than you do. So if the horse wants to gallop off to the right, let's go. And the fun of that is, even you don't know what the destination is now. And as a writer, those are the best moments, when your story surprises you, when you're not sure of the destination anymore, and you're watching. And I always say, if it surprises me, then it's going to surprise the audience as well.
That was poetry, to say the least. Because, and it's not to sound like a super fan or anything, which I kind of am, but that, I think, is a whole bunch of information that the listeners at home, you guys better be listening your ears off on this, because I just found that truly enlightening to myself as a guy who does a shit ton of writing. Like, and you run into those problems. I always think that there's always problems when you're a creative, but almost all of our problems are solvable.
Yes.
Because they're just always in our own head, you know? That's what I've really realized. It's always your own head. And as soon as you conquer that, you can accomplish so damn much.
Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, the flip side to what I just said is, to go back to the sort of the laying pipe metaphor, is that sometimes, and it happens with TV sometimes, they have a story they want to tell for this episode.
Yeah.
And so they hand you all the pieces of pipe of that episode. And it may not be a story that you would have chosen to tell, but that's the gig. So you have to take your technical skills and put them to work, putting this pipe together, so that you can make that good story, even if it may not be the story that you're truly passionate about. And then the flip in the whole thing is, while you're putting the pipe together, you have to find that passion anyway and get passionate about it. You always have to find the thing in that gig, in that story, that you have some passion for. And if you can't find that, and if you're good enough at what you do, you will always find something. Someone comes to you and says, I want you, you know, would you write this character? And maybe you're taking the gig not because you're passionate about that character, but because you need the gig.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, you got to pay the mortgage. So what you do is, you know, while you're putting the pipe together, because you know you can construct stories, you're looking for the thing in this character. You're looking. I always say you're peeling back the top of the head of the character. You're shining a flashlight in there, looking for interesting things in that character's psyche, interesting stories to tell about that person. And they are. And I noticed I said person, not character, because in the end they have to become people to you.
Yeah.
And once they become people to you, then you're set. You know, you're telling a story about a real person and off you go. I've said over the years there are characters that I enjoyed reading, but they may not have been my favorite character. And then I write them and I fall in love with them because I feel like I get to know them the way I would know a dear friend. And that unlocks the key to that character and off you go.
Love it. I mean, you have to. You have to find really something you can relate to in a character. Unless they're like an evil psychopath. Well, then maybe there's 1% of that thing you can relate to. But...
Yeah, but you have to be able to relate to the evil psychopath. Because, and I was just thinking about this earlier today about, you know, the writer's psyche. Mm-hmm. I think the difference between a writer and somebody else is that the writer, if he's doing his job right, is unafraid to look at all those corners of his own psyche where all that ugly stuff lives. Because we all contain it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we all contain the heights of heaven and the depths of hell. And we make choices all the time about which way we're going to go. And, you know, I find it fascinating writing the so-called villains because I want to find the humanity in those villains. And you find the things in yourself that are in them or in people that you know. You know, so I think we contain all of it. And the difference between, you know, the average person walking down the street and the writer is the man or woman who is unafraid to dig through all those ugly corners of the psyche and also is unafraid to climb that mountain to the heights of the most beautiful things in our psyches as well. And then and then to have the courage to express that to the world.
Because
sometimes you're digging in those places and you go, oh, that's in me. maybe I know that's in me, but I can't put that out there in the world. But
yeah.
That's the next step that writers do. We have to be shameless.
It's true.
And there is a certain measure of shamelessness in what we do because you have to be unafraid to put these things out there.
Oh, yeah. And it's, we also take a look and we realize writers understand the fact of they're like, well, it's a villain. Here's no relations. Like, well, no, the villain is the hero, technically, in his own eyes. And
exactly. In his own head, he's the hero of the story.
Yeah, and maybe other people's heads, too, like followers or something like that, like a Quinn and Joker moment. Quinn thinks Joker is a hero, but
right. That's
a whole bucket of worms we're not going to open on that one. But that sense of those people are heroes, maybe not in your eyes, but to other people's eyes in their own. So that's, like, I think people really got to understand.
And it helps us also sometimes just to understand the darkness in the world, you know? If you take a character that is capable of doing these dark things that shock and appall us and root through their psyche and try to understand them, ultimately what you end up with is even though they're doing terrible things, you can still have compassion for them. And that compassion, if you bring that out, and you know, you want your stories to touch people and enlighten them in some way, mm-hmm. You bring that into your life. Well, maybe an act of compassion in real life stops the next villain from happening, you know?
Yes.
You know, people talk about how we treated Germany after the First World War, and had we but perhaps treated them differently, we would not have had what we had during the Second World War, you know? So I think understanding the psyche of the so-called, you know, villain or the so-called other, whatever it is, allows us to look at things from a more compassionate lens.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we condone what they do, but we can still have we can condemn something and still have compassion for the person that did it.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. Now, well, let's talk about this. Do you feel, because I feel this 100%, that sometimes, most of the time, villains are more fun to write than the heroes?
Sometimes. It depends on who the hero is, you know? That's
true.
If the hero is, you know... If the hero is just a one-dimensional, square-jawed hero, then maybe the fault isn't with the character, the fault is with the writer, you know? But yeah, but the villain may be a little bit more interesting because you're sailing into those dark waters, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a little scarier and more interesting, and you're diving into those places we're talking about. But the best heroes have that. The best heroes have those conflicts. Spider-Man, what makes Peter Parker so great is his humanity
and
his flaws and the fact that he is quite capable of screwing screwing up hugely and pretty consistently.
Yeah, he does.
What makes the character great is A, that he does screw up, and B, that when he screws up, he doesn't lay there in a heap, or he may do it for a little while, lay there in a heap and whine and complain, but then he gets up and he tries to make it right.
That's it.
And that's what makes a hero, you know? So, and he's interesting because of that. And so, the, you know, the more conflicts there are inside your hero, the more interesting he is. You know, the old-fashioned sort of 1940s, 50s, I'm, you know, the perfect, well, like the DC characters in the 50s, but when they were all sort of interchangeable and they didn't really have any flaws or problems or anything. We love them as symbols because they can also symbolize something inside us all, and that's why I always think that's why you always have responded to Superman, because, you know, the whole Clark Kent Superman thing, he's like symbolic of the potential that we all have. We all think we're little schmo Clark Kents, but if we just take off our glasses and open our shirt, there's something else going on there that we all have, you know. You know, when Marvel came along and just cracked that open a little bit and started giving us characters with a little more shades of gray in there, it made a big difference. And then, of course, you know, the DC characters started absorbing that as well. And I think that's really important to any great story. You know, who wants to read about anybody that's flawless?
Hey, folks at home, this is your host Dakota here with a little bit of an ad break. Do you guys like the Comic Chronicle podcast, and do you like getting in-depth interviews with people of, moreover, not interviews, but conversations with people in the businesses? Well, guess what? If you love film and television, go check out the Film World podcast that I host on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and filmworld.podbean.com, because I get to talk to people all over from the business of film and TV, of actors, creature actors, writers, directors, cinematographers, all these people, VFX artists, hell. They all come onto the show. We give in-depth conversations about what they do. People from Jurassic World, Planet of the Apes, Transformers, Godzilla, numerous times, you know, and voice actors. And we give all these in-depth conversations with you guys from all sorts of ranges of different things on the Film World podcast. So if you guys like the Comic Chronicle podcast, you'll probably like Film World. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Hopefully you guys are enjoying the show. And now back to the conversation at hand.
It's true. Unless flawless is the problem of the story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have to. You know, the heroes have to be as interesting as the villains, and that's the challenge. Because exactly. The challenge, it works the other way sometimes too, where people just make the villains all evil.
I mean, some of those you could do, there's some that are just pure evil, and I think including Spider-Man, Green Goblin. You know, why does he do most of the things? Because he's a dick.
You know, but Norman Osborn is also someone who is mentally ill and has had a lot of issues, and you can explore that, and loves his son, even though he mistreats his son. Mm. But although that, I have to say, that's why I always preferred the Harry Osborn Green Goblin, and wrote so much about Peter and Harry, was because I found Harry to be more psychologically interesting, and because he's Peter's friend. Yeah. And while he's being the, quote, villain, he still loves Peter.
Yeah.
And Peter still loves him, and yet they have to oppose each other. One is the so-called hero, one is the so-called villain, and yet they're both as conflicted and deep and interesting, and that's why I spent, you know, 2 years when I was writing Spectacular Spider-Man primarily focusing on Peter and Harry, because it was so interesting.
Yeah, and it adds because you gotta be at a human element, I like to say to people, is that if you add that human element, you could have Superman, but he has that human element to him where he could, with the flick, especially with you doing Red Sun, he could easily take over. He could murder everybody and rule the world. But, you know, he's a human. He's like, no, I care for people. He's like, I've had parents. My parents raised me here, my foster parents. Like, Mom, Pa, Kent. And all this stuff, Peter Parker, he messes up and he's like one of the most human. He may have superpowers, but I think other than him and Daredevil, some of Daredevil, they're the most human Marvel characters you can get, because it's the most relatable. And that's what I love about those two, is that...
What's interesting about Daredevil, I always think, you know, Peter is essentially a good and decent guy. He screws up, but he'll always go for his highest motives in the end. Matt Murdock, I think, has a part of him that really enjoys the dark side.
It's true.
So that battle within him is even more in some ways, because he's got these impulses. He's got a dark side that I think he kind of gets off on and enjoys, and he has to get past that and get over it and still do the right thing. You know, which makes it that conflict is really interesting. Years ago, back in the 90s, I worked on an early version of the Daredevil movie. Not the version that ultimately came out. It was with a different director and a different producer. Mm-hmm. But it really allowed me to explore that character in a way I never had before. And then a little later, I got to write the book for a while as well. And that's what I found interesting about him, that there are some very basic dark impulses in this man that he's trying to not just restrain, but vault over to do the right thing. Whereas Peter screws up, and sometimes the consequences of his screw-ups can be terrible, but he wasn't trying to do anything wrong, you know? And he'll always come back and do the right thing. That's his nature, where I think Matt is more of a struggle. But that's true. It makes them really both really, really interesting characters.
It's true. I mean, Matt, in that sense, recently in the books, have you caught up recently on Daredevil?
No, I have not. I have not been up on it recently.
Okay, I don't want to spoil it then, because there is something he does. And I want to tell you, because it is the Matt character of, like, he does it and he confesses. He does it, then he confesses. And it's like this thing of, like, that's him, but he's in a dark moment and he's enjoying it, but he's knowing that he has to get out of what he's doing.
Right.
Because it's, I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's really Matt Murdock, to say the least here. It's like truly him in a sense. Do you mind if I tell you?
No, go ahead.
He's sleeping with this married woman. And he even says, like, in one of the panels for a while, he's like, and it's, she's married, but to, like, a mafia, to, like, mob bosses and whatnot for a crime family, but she's innocent, like a librarian. He's like, we sleep together, then I confess about it in church. We sleep together, then I'm Daredevil. And it's like a whole thing going on when he's like, and he even says, he's like, I know this is bad. I should not be doing, but it's a mob boss. Was it okay? Because I feel like it's bad. And I'm Daredevil. I should know better. So I'm like, yeah, that's Matt Murdock.
Right, exactly. Well, the whole Catholic thing is so fascinating about him, too. Just what you're saying, Catholic and confession. And what it reminds me of is the stories, the real stories that you read about these mob guys. These, you know, Catholic Italian mobsters who are out there doing these terrible things, but at the same time, you know, are going to confession or have to go to church on Sunday. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, their Catholicism is really important to them. And the dichotomy there of, like, well, you know, I'm trying to be a good Catholic and now I'm going to go out and shoot Joe in the back of the head.
That's it.
Well, that's certainly something worth the juicy to explore in a story, you know?
Oh, God, yeah, because it's just, like, it's so juicy and you automatically are hooked of, like, do I love this guy or I hate this guy? Or a girl, you never know. Right. Like, what is happening here?
Exactly.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Now, I do have to ask you this when it comes to your animation stuff, because I'm a huge fan of dark magic stuff. Are you a fan of Constantine? Because you've done, like, a little bit of Constantine work, I've noticed. And, like, because you did the movies, you did Justice League Dark.
Right. Like, well, you know, it's just kind of what I was saying before. I became a Constantine fan writing Constantine.
Ooh.
You know, I was aware of Constantine. I was not like I had never taken a deep dive. I didn't know Constantine like the back of my hand, like I know some characters. So that when I took over Justice League Dark, I had to get familiar with Constantine. And when I wrote the Constantine movie, City of Demons, which is really one of my favorite animated projects that I've ever done, I had to really immerse myself in that character. And immersing myself in that character, I got to know him, and I really got to like that character. It's really, really interesting. Exactly what we're talking about. So many levels, so many conflicts. And there's a guy that's really got the dark impulses, and yet somehow ends up on the side of the angels in the end, you know?
It's true, and he's like the Spider-Man sometimes, because, you know, sometimes he tries to do good, but he ultimately is just so bad things happen. So many bad things happen to him all the time.
Right.
Like, even in the very beginning, like his origin, if they actually do the real origin, some people, sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't. If you do the real origin on him from, like, the girl and, like, his band and whatnot playing with her, the little girl, is like, that's fucked up. You know, like, it doesn't start happy for him, but he always tries. And that's what I love about Constantine. But it's good to know, like, is it because he played music and then became, like, this huge, like, dark magic thing? Is that why you maybe love him a little bit?
Well, I did relate to the musician as well, the musician and him. And again, to bring it back to my Beatles obsession, I'm thinking, here's this guy from Liverpool. He's a musician. He's a tough, really tough, cynical guy, but with a really good heart underneath. And I thought, oh, John Lennon. Okay, got it. You know? So I kept like clicking into John Lennon, especially when I was writing City of Demons, which dealt with a lot of the backstory, you know? So it's a character that I really, really enjoyed. And plus, in the animated form, Matt Ryan is Constantine, as far as I'm concerned. Yes. You know, if they couldn't be better casting. So I was so glad that, you know, after doing the live action show, he did the voice for City of Demons. And, you know, we did a big premiere at WonderCon whenever the movie came out. And really nice guy, really down to earth. Didn't have any of that Hollywood pixie dust about him. You know, he wasn't like, I'm an actor. He was just a regular guy, really nice guy. And I'm so glad that he did the voice, because he is Constantine. He's perfect.
He is. He's definitely, and he's somebody I would love to have a conversation with as an actor too. And I'd love to have him on the show, but he is definitely one where it hooked. Like, his acting really hooked. Here's a fun story, is that when the Constantine show came out, there were so many fans I knew, but the biggest fan I knew that watched it with me, and she always wanted me to come over and sit down with her and watch it, was my grandmother. she loves Constantine. Like, that should tell you about the character. She's like, I love him. I love what he represents, what he does. I love the dark magic sort of thing. And she loves Matt Ryan. She's like, I don't want anybody else to play that character. When I told her that he came back, when the show got canceled, her immediate reaction was like, those motherfuckers. And, like, there was, like, my grandmother in her 70s saying this. And shout out to you, Rita Morgan. We love you. And it was that thing where when I told her that he got cast as the animated voice and that he's come back on Legends of Tomorrow, he came back on Arrow, she's like, good, because Constantine should live forever. And I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah, I really hope they spin him off back into his own show, or at least to, you know, a CW TV movie or something, or a miniseries or something, you know, because he is so good in that part. And he's a lot of fun. Legends of Tomorrow is a lot of fun, but it doesn't allow Constantine to be fully Constantine, you know? It's a different context for him, and it's great to see him, and the show is terrific. But one of the things I really was proud of about City of Angels was that I really feel like we nailed the real Constantine from the comics, you know, with all the darkness and the conflict and everything else. And, you know, obviously part of that was that we were using, we were bouncing off that wonderful graphic novel. So we had great source material to build from, but then we built out from there. And I thought that we really got that Constantine. I'd like to see him once again playing that Constantine, real authentic Constantine.
Now I do.
Or, as I've recently learned, it's really Constantine, apparently.
Ooh, what?
someone corrected me and said, no, it's really Constantine, even though they pronounce it as Constantine on TV. It's Constantine. I forgot who told me, but it was someone who was in the know.
Okay, okay. I'm like, is it Wikipedia?
I figure enough of us call him Constantine at this point that, you know, you can't put that back horse back in the barn.
That's true. That's like the same argument of, it's Ra's al Ghul. No, it's Ra's al Ghul. Well.
Right.
Now, yeah. I don't want to get you in trouble for this, man, but are you attached, or can you talk about, because I think he's in the movie too, that Justice League Dark sequel that got teased the other day?
I don't know anything about it.
Damn it! Okay.
I didn't work on that one.
Oh, man.
I know that it's happening, but I did not work on it.
So that's a shame.
I can't get in any trouble because I don't know anything.
Fair enough! That's awesome. Well, I respect that, and I didn't want to get – that was one of those things. I'm not trying to dig for anything. I just was wondering, because I'm like, you know, you did a super good job on the first one. Please. Damn.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll do a great job. It's just, you know, it's the same group of guys over there at Warner Brothers, you know, Jim Krieg and that whole crew. And they're great. They are so good. It's such a pleasure working with those guys. So I'm sure the next Justice League Dark movie will be terrific.
That's awesome. Well, we're coming to the end of the show here, good man, and I definitely got to say is thank you for coming on the show, because this has been a blast.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's good that, you know, it's nice to just talk about the creative process. Yeah. You know, like I said, there are certain stories of mine that people want to talk about over and over again, and I appreciate that. I really, really do, so I'm not trying to knock that. But there's just so much you can say about the same story and over and over and over again, whereas when you're talking about the creative process, you can talk about that forever.
Oh, yeah. It can be very, very, very helpful to people, too, because there's a lot of people in the business of film and comics who do listen to the show, and I do know that this will help them out a lot. I hope it does. Shit, it's helped me out a little bit.
Well, that's great. So I'll say again, anyone that's listening that's interested, go to my website, jmdmateus.com. Go to the workshop section if you're interested in hearing more like this. Come to the workshop in November. And if I can just plug a few more things.
Yes, plug away.
The collected edition of Girl in the Bay is out now from Dark Horse and Burger Books. The collected edition of a project I did for IDW called Impossible Incorporated just came out a couple of months ago.
I've heard good things
about
that. That's
out now. And looking ahead, we've got Superman Red Sun and the Deathstroke series on CW Seed all coming up probably in the first quarter of the new year.
I think so. If I remember the release dates right, yeah, I believe so. And that
Death Short will be on the Wonder Woman Blu-ray, which is coming out, I think, within the next few weeks.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's really soon. I forgot about that. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm extremely excited for that Red Sun cartoon, because that's one of my top three Superman stories of all time. So
that was – I got to tell you before we go, that was a challenging story to adapt.
Really?
Because it is so packed.
That's true. You know,
in a lot of ways, in a totally different way, but what reminds me of Jack Kirby in the sense that you'd read any random Kirby book, and like every other panel, there's enough ideas that you could spin off into a 6-issue miniseries.
Oh my God, yes.
And Red Sun is so packed with ideas, and when you're taking all that and you're turning it into a 70-80 minute movie, you have to trim a lot of fat and make it more linear. You can't put all that in there, you know? You'd love to stop and take every panel and do, 15 minutes on that. So it was a challenge to find the heart and soul of that story in the straight through line and still be true to the comic, you know? Because it was, like I said, that comic is just filled with so much imagination, and there's so much going on in there.
Oh, God, yeah. You got the Green Lantern Marine Corps. I want to see a miniseries on them because that's awesome.
You will see them in the movie.
Yes,
sure.
thank God.
Because that much I can tell you. Oh, yeah.
And I loved that series. Oh, I think I read that a little bit after it came out in trade paperback. And when I read that, I was like, "This needs." I've been putting it out there that it needs to be an animation movie for so long, or live action. Either one, we need it. So I'm so happy. I have cheered with joy when I saw the announcement. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, I hope it lives up to your expectations and that you enjoy it.
Oh yeah, trust me. I don't go in with the it's not 100% like the book. No, that's if you change a lot, that's fine with me because I still got the final thing, and so that's fine.
The essence of the story is there.
Okay.
You know, and obviously that's why people think that you can just let's just take the book or the comic and just do it exactly as it is. It doesn't work that way. You can't.
No.
Even if it seems like someone's done that, there's a lot of other work that's gone into that and a lot of stuff that gets trimmed and moved around. But I think we are absolutely true to the heart and soul of that story. So.
I love it. Now, before we go to it's part of the contract stuff. Do you have any social media that you'd like to promote?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. You can just find me with my name. And I also, same thing, I have a Facebook page. And I really enjoy the social media. I enjoy the interactions with the fans. Mm. A lot of people complain about Twitter, but I find that if you keep things positive, you bring positive energy back, you know? So that I could probably count on one hand, if not a few fingers, the negative experiences I've had on social media over the years. You know, 99.9% of what I've experienced has been very positive. What's wrong with the fact that there are people out there that read and enjoy your work that want to connect with and talk to you, and you reach out and you talk back with them, and it's a great thing. And also, I have my website, jmdmateus.com. So those three things. There will never be anything else because I don't want to go to Instagram or anything else. I've reached my limit, you know?
But yeah.
Twitter and Facebook and my website, you can find me at any of those, and if you contact me, I will always try to respond.
Awesome. I love it. Love it with a passion. And I going off that, is I positive fan reviews are always the best to read. I do love that with a passion. Like when someone comments something or tweet at me or message me or anything like that, being like, how much, like your book changed my life. And it's like, I'm going to work in as a writer now. I'm like, what? Or it's like, it's mind blowing stuff. This stuff should be movies.
Yes.
And things like, that's amazing. And it'd be like, oh, I love this character here. And I'm like, well, I do too. So that works. Like, thanks for doing it.
You know, or to be at a convention and to have just one person that comes up to tell you how a particular story impacted their life and their thinking and their heart in a really deep way. One person, a whole career is worth that one person. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes.
And I've been lucky enough that has happened, you know, a number of times over the years. And that's one of the reasons, first and foremost, I write for myself. And the second thing I write for is I imagine a person out there who reads with the same passion that, that I do, who takes stories into their heart the same way that I do. And if I can touch, you know, impact someone's life or touch their heart or open their head in some way, what a fantastic thing. And then when someone comes up and tells you that you did that, that's an amazing thing that I never, ever take for granted.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Shit, I had a fan the other day just asked to take a picture and be like, hey, can I have an autograph sort of thing? Like, as the nerdy Midwestern kid that's now living in the Southwest, it all of a sudden was, wow, this is new. Like, this is a whole new world. And the fact that, like, they said all this fun stuff, yeah, you can never take that for granted. And if you do, that's what we talked about at the very beginning, connecting in full circle, you lose your childhood you.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh.
Well, folks at home, if you want to follow me, you can follow me at DakotaMorgan3 on Twitter and then at Dakota_Morgan97 on Instagram. Facebook, my Facebook's private sort of thing there. If you guys send a friend request, depending on who you are, may or may not accept it, but it's just, come on, folks. I had to put that PSA out there. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Any final words?
No, I think we said a lot.
Yeah, it's true, we did.
That's enough.
We did. Yeah,
but it's been great talking to you. I've enjoyed the conversation.
You as well, good man. You as well. And, it's been a blast. Well, and on that note, stay classy, leaguers. A Nerd with Balls production.